Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 881, Turkey Shoot, Sleepwalking into World War III. This program is being recorded on December 13th of the year 2015. In this program, we are going to be analyzing the shootdown of a Russian Su-24 fighter bomber by a Turkish F-16. That shootdown has generated a lot of controversy. It also has precipitated some situations which could make a future encounter between Russian aircraft and Turkish aircraft. Bear in mind that Turkey is not only a NATO country, but is an Islamist country dominated by the Erdogan government that is sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood and networks with the Bank al-Taqwa and has been supporting Islamist slash Turkish, Turkist elements in Syria and doing so in combination with the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood and elements of CIA, as we looked at in 878 and, for the record, 880. The circumstances surrounding the shootdown of that Su-24 are even more ominous than I had suspected at first. From the get-go, it not only struck me as an act of war, but something that had in all probability been planned in advance by the Turks. Normally when an aircraft strays into foreign airspace, the protocol is to intercept it, to have an interceptor aircraft fly on a parallel course and communicate visually and or via radio that they are intruding in airspace and should leave at once. You don't simply shoot the plane down without warning. Now, the Turks have claimed that they did broadcast about 10 different warnings to the Russian plane, and that remains to be seen. For one thing, as we will see, the Turks claim they broadcast the warnings on both VHF and UHF radio frequencies, as is well known to Turkish and NATO intelligence. The Su-24s are not equipped to get UHF radio transmissions. So the author, the analyst who is consulted in the article that will comprise most of our program, said that the warnings may very well have been transmitted in such a way that they knew that the Russian aircraft would not have received them. He also speculates about the possibility that the Russian aircraft radios were on the spritz. There's yet another possibility I would suggest, and I don't know for sure. I would not entirely dismiss the notion that the whole thing was fabricated, that in fact no warnings were transmitted at all, or as the author says, there were Turkish broadcast warnings, but they were on a frequency that they knew the Russian planes would not receive. International protocol in such matters dictates that the intercepting aircraft should conduct the communications, and that certainly was not the case. Beyond that, the analyst consulted by the author makes a number of points. First of all, if, in fact, and it is not clear that the Russian aircraft actually did violate Turkish airspace, but if it did, it would have flown over a small finger-like area of Turkish territory that sticks into Syria. And if so, they would have only been over that territory for a few seconds. When the plane was shot down, it was clearly several miles south of Turkish airspace. And beyond that, the Su-24 aircraft had made an attack run and were then doing a U-turn over what the analyst describes as a racetrack-like pattern, and had just headed in and made a second attack when one of the aircraft was shot down. And that would not have been when the incursion occurred. So when the plane was shot down, it was undoubtedly in Syrian territory. Beyond that, Some of the key points of analysis presented here. The Turkish aircraft had flown below the below where Russian and Syrian radar would have been able to detect them. And in order to do this, were flying at low altitude and burning up a great deal of fuel. The analyst says that means they were undoubtedly refueled by American-made tanker aircraft of the Turkish Air Force prior to the attack. They then loitered below Russian and Syrian radar, the altitude at which Russian and Syrian radar could have detected them. And then after the Su-24 made its second attack run inside of Syrian territory, the F-16 then rose up to perfect firing position, fired a missile, then executed a hard right turn, dove down, violating Turkish or Syrian airspace. In so doing, dove down once again below Russian and Syrian radar detection altitudes, and then would have been refueled on its way back to its airbase. The author also points out that in response to this, in addition to the fact that there are now going to be interceptor aircraft that will be accompanying the Russian planes on combat missions, they have installed their S-400, their most sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles, at the Latakia Air Base. They have a range extending some 200 miles in the Turkish airspace. And the analyst points out that this does not preclude the possibility of a future attack, but if the Turks do stage another attack, this would give the Russians the capability of shooting down either the attacking aircraft or one of its buddies, so to speak, on the way back to its base. This could very easily lead to World War III. And this is all against the background of the series of overlapping covert operations, WikiLeaks to begin with, the Arab Spring, the Snowden operation, the Maidan coup, and now what we are seeing with Islamist and pan-Turkist elements heavily overlapped and operating as proxy warriors from China to the Middle East to the Caucasus to the Ukraine. We don't have time to go into all of this. This is very, very scary indeed, and I think the possibility of a third world war has never been greater. Most of the program is going to consist of the reading of a very important article from Harper's Magazine of December 4th of 2015, an article called Mountain Ambush by Andrew Coburn, reads as follows. What Andrew Coburn has done is to interview defense analyst Pierre Spray. Pierre Spray, P-I-E-R-R-E-S-P-R-E-Y, was one of the people who developed the F-16 aircraft. He also, by the way, was consulted by Peter Lavende in writing The Hitler Legacy. He was one of the people who told Peter about Hans-Ulrich Rudel's role in developing the F-16. So here is Mountain Ambush by Andrew Coburn in Harper's Magazine, December 4th of 2015. The article begins. On November 24th, a Turkish F-16 fighter jet shot down a Russian Su-24 fighter bomber near the border of Turkey and Syria. In the immediate aftermath, officials from the two countries offered contradictory versions of what transpired. Russian President Vladimir Putin claimed that the plane was flying over Syrian territory when it was downed. Russian President Erdogan countered that it was inside Turkey's border and had been warned 10 times to alter its course. Hours later, President Obama threw his support behind Erdogan. Turkey, he said, has a right to defend its territory and its airspace. I asked Pierre Spray, a longtime defense analyst and member of the team that developed the F-16, to examine what we know about the downing and determine what actually occurred that morning. Coburn then asks, the Russians have claimed the November 24th downing of their bomber was a deliberate, pre-planned ambush by the Turks. Is there any merit in that argument? And then Spray says, looking at the detailed Russian timeline of what happened, as well as the much less detailed Turkish radar maps, I'd say the evidence looks pretty strong that the Turks were setting up an ambush. They certainly weren't doing anything that would point to a routine air patrol along the border. Their actions in no way represented a routine, all-day-long type of patrol. Coburn then asks, how can we tell that? Well, let's set up the situation, and it will be a little easier to understand. The Russian pilots were assigned a target very close to the Turkish border, about 10 miles in from the Mediterranean coast, and about 5 miles south of an important border crossing at a little place called Yayladagi. That's Yayladagi. I'm probably mispronouncing that. That's a border crossing that the Turks had used to slip jihadists into Syria, or to allow them to slip in. It's also a place where there's quite a bit of truck traffic, a fair amount of it probably oil tankers. It's the only crossing for many, many miles around. This is a pretty sparsely populated, well-forested, and hilly area occupied by Turkmen, Turkish-speaking Syrian tribesmen who are sympathetic to al-Nusra, parenthetically, basically al-Qaeda in Iraq when it operates in Syria, and the Islamic State, who harbor Chechen terrorists and who we know have been supported by the Turks. Know that there are Chechen terrorists who also operate in this area. Continuing, the target area the Russians were interested in was about 5 miles south along the road leading to this crossing. That was the target area that they assigned to these two Su-24s on the day of the shootdown. The crews were assigned the mission at about 9:15 in the morning Moscow time. They took off about a half hour later, headed for an area about 30 miles inland from the Mediterranean coast, in other words, well east of this target area, to loiter until they got further instructions on hitting a target in the target area. At this point, they're just cruising and loitering at 18,000, 19,000 feet, trying to conserve gas while they're waiting to be assigned a specific target. The flight to their holding area was very, very short because they were flying out of a Russian base south of Latakia, that's L-A-T-A-K-I-A. It was like a 10-minute flight. They were only about 30 miles or so away. After they reached their loiter area at roughly a quarter to 10, they were well in view of Turkish radar coverage because they were up high and not far from the border, roughly 16 miles south of the border. They got assigned their target, which was the road south of this important border crossing, and executed a first strike, each of them attacking separate targets at about a quarter after 10. They then made a U-turn, so to speak, to follow a racetrack pattern back toward where they had been loitering to get ready for a second attack. They, in fact, executed the second attack at about 7 or 8 minutes later. One of the two Su-24s hit its target right about 10:24 and was almost immediately shot down as he was pulling off the target.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Then Coburn asks, what about the Turkish Air Force? What were they doing meanwhile? The Turks had launched two F-16s quite a bit earlier than the time we're talking about from Diyarbakir, that's D-I-Y-A-R-B-A-K-I-R, a major base for the Turkish Air Force about 250 miles away, to loiter just in from the Mediterranean over a mountainous area that was about 25 miles north of this border crossing. Interestingly, they arrived in that area to loiter just about the time the Russian pilots were being assigned their targets, and the F-16s loitered over that mountainous area for about an hour and 15 minutes. Here's the crucial thing. They were not loitering up at high altitudes, say 20 to 30,000 feet to conserve fuel, which is where you would normally be loitering if you were simply doing a routine border patrol. They were loitering quite low at about 7,500 to 8,000 feet, which first of all is below the coverage of the Syrian and Russian radars that were down around Latakia, and which is a very fuel-inefficient altitude at which to loiter. You suck up a lot of gas down at those low altitudes. That tells you right away, if they hung out there for about 75 minutes, that they must have been tanked on the way into that mission because they were quite far from their home base, 250 miles, so they must have topped off on fuel to have enough to even last for an hour and a quarter at this inefficient, low altitude. The Turkish Air Force does have a number of American tankers that they own, so they certainly could have, and almost beyond a shadow of a doubt, did tank these F-16s before this whole engagement. They're hanging out at low altitude over this mountainous area north of the border, and now it's about a quarter after 10. The Russian fighters, the Su-24s, are just finishing their racetrack pattern after their first strike and are about to reattack from this holding position well east of the target. At that point, the two F-16s break out of their loiter patterns to fly through in a straight line south, quite certainly under Turkish ground control because they clearly are not hunting for the Su-24s and following a curved path like the Russian aircraft. They are heading straight for an intercept point that apparently ground control has provided them, a point that's very close to the target that the Su-24s have just bombed. That's clearly the point they're coming back to bomb again. The F-16s arrived quite nicely and precisely timed to a missile shooting position very near the border and 3 to 4 miles from the second Su-24, who has just finished bombing his second target at about 10:24. One of the F-16s locks onto him, launches a missile, an infrared missile, according to the Russians, and immediately dives back down to get back under the Syrian radar coverage. The F-16 makes a hard, diving right turn and is back under 8,000 feet in no time at all and heading north away from the scene of the engagement. In that turn, he actually is penetrating Syrian airspace before he heads north to go home to Diyarbakir, probably at that point and out of fuel, hooking up with a tanker aircraft again in order to make it home. Coburn then asks, would he have been in Syrian airspace when they fired the missile? Not necessarily. It's hard to tell at this point. All this action is pretty close to the border, and there's no reason to believe either the Turks or the Russians about distances of half a mile or a mile north or south of the border, but there's no question that the Turkish F-16 penetrated Syrian airspace in executing his diving turn to get out of the area. He was heading due south to attack the east-west track of the Su-24 that had just finished bombing the target. That Su-24 augured in almost immediately, about a mile and a half south of the border. The bone of contention here is not the target area. The target area is roughly 4 or 5 miles south of that famous border crossing we were just talking about. The bone of contention is a narrow finger of Turkish land about 5 miles long, sticking straight down into Syria about a mile and a half at its widest at the northern end, and tapering down to a half mile at the southern tip. That finger is a good 6 miles east of the target area. So when heading west on their way to attack their targets, the Su-24s necessarily had to pass very close to the southern tip of the finger. In other words, The whole controversy about whether the shoot-down was legitimate or not is whether the Su-24s on the way to the target happened to cross that finger for a few seconds. Remember again the setup. You've got a target that's like 10 miles in from the Mediterranean to the east. Another 6 miles or so east of this, there is this finger of land. It's well east of the target area. The larger area that the Sukhois were coming from is another 16 miles to the east of that. They're flying from their larger area, which is well south of the border. They're flying past the finger. Maybe they crossed it. Maybe they were just below it, heading for the target. Kuban then asks, but if the Russians were in Turkish airspace at the Turks claim, wouldn't it be reasonable for the Turks to intercept them? There's a little detail that's very telling. The alleged border crossing took place on the first bombing run from the loiter area to the target, and according to the Turks, the Russians were roughly half a mile north of the tip of the finger, and so they were in Turkish airspace for about 17 seconds, a tiny, short, brief time on their way to hitting the first target. The Russians, of course, say they were south of the finger by about a mile. God knows who's right. I'm sure if we had access to the radar records, we could tell very promptly who's lying and who's not. But nobody is going to give us access to the exact radar plot. Here's the very interesting thing. This border-violating incursion, or perhaps you should have said this alleged border-violating incursion, was on the first run to the target at around quarter after 10 a.m. On the second run to the target, the Russian planes were very clearly further to the south. This is according to the plots and maps released in the Russian briefing, which are very, very detailed with exact time marks every minute. The 17-second crossing of the border alleged by the Turks happened at about a quarter after 10, but the Turks waited. They didn't come in and attack the airplane that had crossed the border at that point. They simply sat and waited until the plane flew a long re-attack pattern and came back on a second run 7 or 8 minutes later, and that is when they attacked and shot him down. Between the fuel-guzzling low altitude of the holding pattern of the F-16s, which miraculously coincided with the flight times of the Russian airplanes, and the fact that they didn't even chase the airplane immediately upon its alleged border incursion, all that smells very much like a pretty pre-planned operation. The Turks allowed the Russian plane to hit a target and make a long 7 or 8 minute re-attack pass, and then came in from their hidden low-altitude position. They came up a little higher to gain a good firing altitude, came whistling south, hit the Su-24, dove under the radar coverage at the same time that they entered Syrian airspace, and headed north out of radar coverage to head back to Diyarbakir. One more time, because this is really crucial. Between the fuel-guzzling low altitude of the holding patterns of the F-16s, which miraculously coincided with the flight times of the Russian aircraft, and the fact that they didn't even chase the airplane immediately upon its alleged border incursion, all that smells pretty much like a pre-planned operation. The Turks allowed the Russian plane to hit a target and make a long 7 or 8 minute re-attack pass, and then came in from their hidden low-altitude position. They came up a little higher to gain a good firing altitude, came whistling south, hit the Su-24, dove under the radar coverage at the same time that they entered Syrian airspace, and headed north out of radar coverage to head back to Diyarbakir, parenthetically also in all probability, or certainly according to Pierre Spray, being refueled by a Turkish tanker aircraft on the way back. Continuing. Such an ambush would not have been hard to pull off, because the Russians, in their detailed account of this, state very clearly that they had coordinated with NATO with the Americans, announcing this attack well in advance, and had followed the protocol of listening on the NATO-agreed frequency for any warnings or alerts from NATO or from the Turks. There was plenty of time for the Americans to inform the Turks that this mission was taking place. They might even have been informed by the Russians the day before it was going to take place. All the prerequisites for a setup were there. Kulbanen asks, the Turks made a big deal about the 10 warnings they said they issued to the Russian planes. What do we make of that? Again, that's one of the things where it's hard to tell and hard to know which side to believe. The Russians in their briefing, in their detailed briefing, are very clear and very adamant that the F-16s themselves, the attacking F-16s, never transmitted any warning. Nor are the Turks or the Americans claiming that the F-16s warned the Russian fighters. But, of course, the international protocols for defending against incursions of your airspace require the attacking fighters themselves to inform the target visually or by radio, whether it's an airliner or a fighter or whatever, that they are now violating airspace and need to turn away. The Turks do say they transmitted their warnings from a ground control station. They also claim they transmitted these radio calls on both the civilian International Emergency Guard UHF band frequency and on the military VHF band frequency previously agreed to by NATO and the Russians. The Americans were quick to confirm that their monitoring equipment picked up the Turkish ground station radio warning calls, but they've been careful not to say what frequency they heard. Now, it so happens that the Su-24s have no radios on board for receiving UHF frequency signals, a fact which is well known to American, NATO, and Turkish intelligence. There's a lot of outs to this that could be the fault of either side. It's quite likely true that the Turks radioed warnings, but those warnings may have been deliberately transmitted only on the international civilian frequency, so that the Su-24s would never hear them. Or it may be that the Su-24s' military frequency radios were on the Fritz, which is easy to believe given the well-known unreliability of Russian electronics. I do believe that the F-16s never issued any warnings because it would be astonishing if they did. Here they went to all the trouble of tanking up and flying at a very low altitude, stretching their fuel endurance just to stay out of radar coverage of the Russians and the Syrians, and why would they suddenly announce that they were there by warning the fighters when they had so obviously set up a situation where they were hiding? The ground control station in Turkey probably did issue warnings, but they may have been warnings that were intended not to be received.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Colburn then asks, would the U.S. have had radar coverage from its airborne warning and control system, or from their facilities at INCIRLIK, that's INCIRLIK, would they be able to watch what was going on? It's very likely that they had a good track on that area, probably just as good as the Turks had. The Turks, of course, have a fairly extensive border network of radars, and the Russians and the Syrians have well mapped those radars and know exactly where the coverage is, which is why the Russians can be so precise as to say that the Su-24s entered Turkish radar coverage at 9:52, because they know pretty exactly where that radar coverage is. The Americans could very possibly have access to those radar results. I have no idea whether they had an AWACS in the air at the time, but if they did, it would have been easy to cover that area too. For sure, the Americans had complete radio monitoring coverage of that area. Certainly heard all the radio transmissions involved. Now, the Russians say that they activated air defense, Kobinin asks here. Now, the Russians say that they activated air defense missiles, the famous S-400, I guess, to make sure this doesn't happen again. Does that indeed preclude the Turks interfering with the Russians carrying out strikes in this area? The answer is no, but it's a hell of a threat. The longest-range version of the S-400 is good for 250 miles. The Russians are installing it at their base just south of Latakia, within 50 miles of the border. So conceivably, they could shoot 200 miles into Turkey. They may or may not be able to prevent a hidden Turkish fighter from firing at another Russian attack in the border area, but they certainly have the possibility of catching him or his friends on the way home. This is a real sword poised over the heads of the Turks now that the Russians have the capability to shoot deep into Turkey and can do so any time they want. Apparently, they also, the Russians, that is, are also deploying interceptor aircraft to escort their bombers. One of the things, well, there are a great many things to take note of in that passage. If basically what Turkey is doing is providing air cover. We're going to repeat part of an article that we have read before. The Turkish are providing air cover for basically al-Nusra and Islamic State fighters who are heavily overlapped with Turkmen who are being supported by Turkey. So basically, the difference, by the way, between air cover and air support. Air cover concerns using combat aircraft to neutralize an enemy's combat aircraft, thereby protecting one's own ground forces. Air support refers to using combat aircraft to act against an enemy's ground forces, sort of like airborne artillery. But the Turks, again, Turkey is a NATO country. It is also, as we looked at in our series about the Arab Spring, Turkish Taffy, Parts 1, 2, and 3, it also is an Islamist country with profound links to the Muslim Brotherhood, the milieu of the Bank al-Taqwa, and overlapping that Muslim Brotherhood-based Islamism is a pan-Turkist neo-Ottoman agenda that is manifesting itself in conjunction with this. Again, these Turkmen here, sympathetic to and overlapping the Nusra Front, which basically is al-Qaeda in Iraq when it operates in Syria. It's al-Qaeda in Iraq when it operates in Syria. It is the Nusra Front. This is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization. And also the Islamic State, and both Nusra and Islamic State have Grey Wolf-connected Turkmen operating with them. For the record, 878, we noted that when the pilot of that rush, Su-24, bailed out, he was shot to death by Turkish militia in that area. The leader of that militia, Alparslan Shalik, is a member of the Grey Wolves. His father is a mayor of a town in Turkey who is a member of the National Action Party of Alparslan Türkeş. Basically, the Turkish have been flying air cover for the Islamic State and the al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front in Syria. If, in fact, Turkey does attempt another attack, it's possible, if the Russians fire back, we could very easily be in World War III. We have noted in past programs, for the record, 878, 879, and 880, about the profound degree of overlap between the forces now fighting in the Middle East and also elsewhere in the Earth Island, from Ukraine all the way on through Xinjiang province in China and Thailand. The Turkish militia that killed the Russian pilot, the head of that, Alparslan Türkeş, is a member of the Turkish Grey Wolves. The Grey Wolves have also been very active in Turkey against China. They have been very supportive of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province, and an apparent Grey Wolf operative has been detained by the Thai authorities for allegedly setting off the bomb attack in Thailand, apparently directed at Chinese tourists who were visiting a shrine in Bangkok. This in retaliation for Bangkok, for Thailand, having extradited a bunch of Uyghurs back to China. We also have pan-Turkish connected Crimean Tatars working with private sector to not only sabotage the Crimean power system, but also blocking road traffic into Crimea. And in both of those capacities, they have been operating with private sector, one of the OUNB heirs governing Ukraine today, and the chief of Ukrainian intel, Valentin Nalavichenko, is basically joined at the hip with private sector. We've also noted that the UNASO, the military component of the OUNB heirs that are active, that are basically in control in Ukraine, fought in Chechnya and in the Caucasus, and then they came home. Their militia was headed by Yuri Shukievich, the son of Roman Shukievich, who was the head of the UPA, the Ukrainian Fighting Formation, the military wing of OUNB that fought with the Third Reich. It was the Noctegal Battalion, headed by Roman Shukievich, and with its political officer, having been Theodor Oberlander of the SS, that performed the pogrom in the Lvov ghetto in 1941. So when we see ISIS-linked Chechen fighters in Ukraine fighting under private sector administrative control, that is not surprising. We are also seeing Chechen terrorists operating in this area where the Russians attacked. I have referred to this series of overlapping covert operations with the confluent Muslim-based Islamist movement and pan-Turkish movement operating all the way from the Middle East, the Ukraine, all the way across the Earth Island to China and Xinjiang province and Thailand. I have called that the Earth Island boogie. WikiLeaks, the Arab Spring, the Maidan coup, even the Orange Revolution, and now the Syrian civil war, which, by the way, is a direct outgrowth of the Arab Spring. That's when this thing got going. And it is also a proxy war between the West and Russia, using Shia Islamists on the Russian side, and also in the case of Assad, the secular government, and Sunni forces on the side of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the West, a.k.a. NATO. About the disposition of the forces in the area that was being attacked by the Russian aircraft, an article by Gareth, G-A-R-E-T-H, Porter, P-O-R-T-E-R, from Consortium News of November 30th of 2015, facts back Russia on Turkish attack. This reads in part, skipping down. The motive for the strike, apparently, against the Russian aircraft was directly related to the Turkish role in supporting the anti-Assad forces in the vicinity of the border. In fact, the Erdogan government made no effort to hide its aim in the days before the attack. In a meeting with the Russian ambassador on November 20th, the foreign minister accused the Russians of, quote, intensive bombing, unquote, of civilian Turkmen villages, unquote, and said there might be, quote, serious consequences, unquote, unless the Russians ended their operations immediately. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu, D-A-V-U-T-O-G-L-U, was even more explicit, declaring that Turkish security forces, quote, have been instructed to retaliate against any development that would threaten Turkey's border security. Davutoglu further said, if there is an attack that would lead to an intense influx of refugees to Turkey, required measures would be taken both inside Syria and Turkey. Note that this is a sparsely populated area. There is not a lot of the civilian population here. Continuing. The Turkish threat to retaliate not against Russian penetration of its airspace, but in response to very broadly defined circumstances on the border, came amid the latest in a series of battles between the Syrian government and religious fighters. The area where the plane was shot down is populated by the Turkmen minority. They have been far less important than foreign fighters and other forces who have carried out a series of offensives in the area since mid-2013, aimed at threatening President Bashar al-Assad's main Alawite redoubt on the coast in Latakia province. Charles Lister, L-I-S-T-E-R, the British specialist who was visiting Latakia province frequently in 2013, noted in an August interview of that year, quote, Latakia, right up to the very northern tip, i.e. the Turkmen Mountain area, has been a stronghold for foreign-based fighter groups for almost a year now. He also observed that after Islamic State, also known as ISIS, ISIL, or Daesh, had emerged in the north, Al Nusra Front and its allies in the area had reached out, unquote, to ISIL, and that one of the groups fighting in Latakia had, quote, become a front group for ISIL. In March of 2014, the religious rebels launched a major offensive with heavy Turkish logistical support to capture the Armenian town of Kesab, K-E-S-S-A-B, on the Mediterranean coast of Latakia, very close to the Turkish border. An Istanbul newspaper, Bacılar, B-A-G-C-I-L-A-R, quoted a member of the Turkish Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee as reporting testimony from villagers living near the border that thousands of fighters had streamed across five different border points in cars with Syrian plates to participate in the offensive. During that offensive, moreover, a Syrian jet responding to the offensive against Kassab was shot down by the Turkish Air Force in a remarkable parallel to the downing of the Turkish jet. Turkey claimed that the jet had violated its airspace but made no pretense about having given any prior warning. The purpose of trying to deter Syria from its air power in defense of the town was obvious. Now, the battle in Latakia province has shifted to the Bayar Bucak area, B-A-Y-R-B-U-C-A-K, where the Syrian Air Force and ground forces have been trying to cut the supply lines between the villages controlled by Nusra Front and its allies and the Turkish border for several months. The key village in the Nusra Front, parenthetically Al-Qaeda, area of control is Salma, S-A-L-M-A, which has been in jihadist hands ever since 2012. The intervention of the Russian Air Force in the battle has given a new advantage to the Syrian army. The Turkish shootdown was thus, in essence, an effort to dissuade the Russians from continuing their operations in the area against Al-Nusra Front and its allies, using not one, but two distinct pretexts. On the one hand, a very dubious charge of a Russian border penetration for NATO allies, and on the other, a charge of bombing Turkmen civilians for the Turkish domestic audience. Note again, this is a sparsely populated area. And again, I can't stress too strongly the point that I made in For the Record 880. The distinction between these various Sunni Islamist cadre is largely academic. The Nusra Front, for example, which is receiving aid from the West, is basically Al-Qaeda in Iraq when it operates in Syria. And there are strong links between Al-Nusra Front and ISIS, although we're being told they are opponents.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Also, be aware that elements of CIA have been supporting the combatants in Syria in combination with Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And again, these are forces that have fought against American military personnel and obviously have killed civilians in France. And who knows about the San Bernardino attack? They certainly were Islamists. They pledged allegiance. Ms. Malik pledged allegiance to ISIS on a Facebook page. However, it appears that they were actually in touch with other Sunni Muslim Brotherhood-inspired or based terrorists before ISIS actually formally developed. We also looked at the fact, as we reviewed information from a declassified DIA document from August of 2012, that the setting up of a caliphate in Islamic state in eastern Syria was something that was supported by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the West. What happened was that it then began going into first Iraq and now other places as well. And basically they created a Frankenstein's monster, just as they did in Afghanistan when the forces that we used to fight Russia, the Soviet Union, I should say, morphed into Al-Qaeda and also the Taliban, and have killed a great many Americans and other people in the time since. And we have been bogged down in gigantic wars, a huge grinding war in Afghanistan for years, and there is no sign of its ending satisfactorily any time soon. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, by the way, now the Nusra Front in the Syrian war, fought against the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, the Dark Horse Regiment at Fallujah, one of the most ferocious engagements of the Iraq War. I wonder how the Marines, the veterans of 3-5 Marines, feel about the fact that the CIA and our so-called allies like Saudi Arabia and Turkey are now basically backing those same combatants, only they're fighting in Syria. I also noted this is not unlike World War II, when the Japanese and Germans, who were financed in many ways by American and British-based transnational corporations, they were supposed to go get the Soviet Union and crush labor movements wherever their forces went in. And they did just that. However, Japan never actually fought against the Soviet Union, but they did what they were supposed to do. And they were not supposed to attack the U.S. However, it's very much like Frankenstein's monster, or Al-Qaeda and Taliban. Once again, Islamist proxy warriors that have been supported by the West, and including elements of CIA, basically also implementing the transnational corporatist agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, are now killing Americans and many other people as well. This is also driving the political spectrum to the right everywhere, in Europe, in the U.S., and it is something upon which the Islamic State is counting. And for the record, 830, Machiavelli 2.0, I know that basically that the reactionaries running against the Islamists in Europe and in the U.S. are saying basically, you see, you can't trust those Muslims, they're treacherous, you have to support us, we're the only ones you can trust. And in turn, the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which is no civil rights organization, it's basically a front for the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Islamic State and the others are saying, you see, you can't trust those infidels, those Europeans and the Americans. They will never trust you. You will always be aliens in their society. You need to support us. And it is working really, really well. I think the implications of this incident could not be exaggerated. Reviewing some of the key talking points from this Harper's article, the area that was attacked by the Russian aircraft is a key crossing point for support from Turkey for the Islamic State and for the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, when it operates in Syria. The SU-4s were assigned a target in the area. NATO was warned well in advance of this. The alleged border incursion, if it occurred, would have occurred on the first pass of the Russian combat aircraft. The attack took place when the planes had done a U-turn, racetrack-like flight path, and had launched a second attack well south of the border, not in Turkish territory, and were then shot down by the Turkish aircraft. A key point in this discussion, again, the thesis statement was summed up by Pierre Spray. Again, one of the people who developed the F-16, not somebody I think who could be called, not even by our slanted media, a Russian or Kremlin stooge, although we may hear that. Spray said, looking at the detailed Russian timeline of what happened, as well as the much less detailed Turkish radar maps, I'd say the evidence looks pretty strong that the Turks were setting up an ambush. They certainly weren't doing anything that would point to a routine air patrol along the border. And again, a note that, again, quoting Pierre Spray, The Russian craft made a U-turn, so to speak, to follow a racetrack pattern back toward where they had been loitering to get ready for a second attack. They, in fact, executed the second attack about 7 or 8 minutes later. One of the two Su-24s hit its target at about 10:24 and was almost immediately shot down as it was pulling off the target. Talking about the Turkish F-16s. Interestingly, they arrived in that area to loiter just about the time that the Russian pilots were being assigned their targets, and the F-16s loitered over that mountainous area for about an hour and 15 minutes. Another key point is the altitude at which they were loitering and what that means. Here's the crucial thing. They were not loitering up at high altitude, say 20 to 30,000 feet to conserve fuel, which is where you would normally be loitering if you were simply doing a routine border patrol. They were loitering quite low at about 7,500 to 8,000 feet, which, first of all, is below the coverage of the Syrian and Russian radars that were down around Latakia, and which is a very fuel-inefficient altitude at which to loiter. You suck up a lot of gas down at those low altitudes. And more about what Pierre Spray feels this indicates. That tells you right away, if they hung out there for 75 minutes, they must have been tanked on the way into that mission because they were quite far from their home base, 250 miles, so they must have topped up on fuel to have enough to even last for an hour and a quarter at this inefficient low altitude. The Turkish Air Force does have a number of American tankers that they own, so they clearly could have, and almost beyond the shadow of a doubt, did tank these F-16s before this whole engagement. And after that, noting the curious behavior of the F-16s, curious, I believe, belongs to quotes. At that point, the two F-16s break out of their loiter patterns to fly, and this is as the Russian aircraft are launching their second target attack run. At that point, the two F-16s break out of their loiter patterns to fly in a straight line south, quite certainly near Turkish, under Turkish ground control, because they clearly are not hunting for the Su-24s and following a curved path. They're heading straight for an intercept point that apparently ground control has provided them, a point that's very close to the target that the Su-24s have just bombed. That's clearly the point they're coming back to bomb again. And of the attack itself, the F-16s arrived quite nicely and precisely timed to a missile shooting position very near the border and 3 to 4 miles from the second Su-24, who has just finished bombing his second target at about 10:24. One of the F-16s locks onto him, launches a missile, an infrared missile, according to the Russians, and immediately dives down to get back under the Syrian radar coverage. Still more. The F-16 makes a hard diving right turn and is back down under 8,000 feet in no time at all, heading north away from the scene of the engagement. In that turn, he actually is penetrating Syrian airspace before he heads north to go home to Diyarbakir, probably at that point out of fuel and hooking up with a tanker again in order to make it home. And talking about the alleged warning that was transmitted to the Russian aircraft, here's the very interesting thing. This border-violating incursion was on the first run to the target at around quarter after 10 a.m., on the second run to the target, the Russian planes were clearly further to the south. This is according to the plots and maps released in the Russian briefing, which are very, very detailed with exact time marks every minute. The 17-second crossing of the border alleged by the Turks happened at about a quarter after 10, but the Turks waited. They didn't come in and attack the airplane that had crossed the border at that point. They simply sat and waited until the plane flew a long reattack pattern and came back on a second run 7 or 8 minutes later, and that's when they attacked and shot him down. And though the alleged warnings that were broadcast, the Turks do say they transmitted their warnings from a ground control station. They also claim they transmitted those radio calls on both the Civilian International Emergency Guard UHF band frequency and on the military VHF band frequency previously agreed to by NATO and the Russians. The Americans were quick to confirm that their monitoring equipment picked up the Turkish ground station radio warning calls, but they've been careful not to say what frequency they heard. Now, it so happens that Su-24s have no radios on board for receiving UHF frequency signals, a fact which is well known to American, NATO, and Turkish intelligence. And more about this. The ground control station in Turkey probably did issue warnings, but they may have been warnings that were intended not to be received. Analyst Pierre Spray also notes that the standard international protocol would have called for the intercepting aircraft to broadcast the warnings, and they almost certainly did not do that. Again, their behavior lurking below Russian and Syrian radar, burning up a lot of fuel, getting refueled to and apparently from their attack, then rising up, shooting down the Russian aircraft on its second run to the target, well inside of Syrian territory, then executing a right-hand turn, violating Syrian airspace, diving back below Russian and Syrian air cover, and flying back to base with, in all probability, assistance from Turkish tanker aircraft. And again, the analyst notes that the S-400 anti-aircraft system that has been introduced in Syria can fire some 200 miles inside of Turkey, should Turkey decide to do this again. Turkey is not only, again, an Islamist country supporting Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. It also is manifesting a heavily overlapped neo-Ottoman pan-Turkish agenda, and it is a NATO country at the same time. This is incredibly dangerous, and, you know, this isn't a video game, people. This could easily result in a Third World War, and it is very, very scary indeed. I can't encourage listeners strongly enough to use the long article length descriptions from the Spitfire website. The description for this show will be up presently, later on the day it is being recorded. And please use the broadcasts and the written descriptions for the broadcasts of other programs relating to this, in particular the programs about the Ukraine and, for the record, 862, 863, 872, and 878, 79, and 880, because they are critical to understanding this, and that this is a very, very scary situation indeed. Watching the juvenile, frankly, or adolescent clucking of tongues about, you know, Putin and what he is or is not doing, and it is very disturbing indeed. Again, bringing to mind author Edith Wharton, who observed the quote, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys." And whether it winds up destroying all of us remains to be seen. Please note, too, that the social fallout from the events in Syria are driving the political spectrum way to the right, both in Europe and in the U.S. In successive days, on Friday, December 11th, and Saturday, December 12th, the New York Times has had op-ed columns by Paul Krugman and Timothy Egan noting how the political reaction in the U.S. basically augurs a slide into fascism, or something very much relating, very, very similar to what Paul Krugman termed that 30s show. So just how far down things go remains to be seen. This concludes For the Record 881, Turkey Shoot, Sleepwalking into World War III. This is being recorded on December 13th. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.